Blog Talk Radio.
Well, welcome everybody. Welcome to Truth Emerges Network. And this is your host, Anarchy Austin Thomas, for today's edition of Unraveling the Matrix. Today we're going to discuss statist rituals. That's correct, statist rituals here on Unraveling the Matrix. If you want to call in, we have open lines, 347-855-8301. Press 1, lets me know you're in the queue, you want to participate. And, of course, you can always listen live at the link provided in the show promo and the archive on the same line. Today we're going to discuss statism, indoctrination, the Pledge of Allegiance, the National Anthem, Constitution, Bill of Rights, perception management, brainwashing, laws, judicial system, oath of office, representative governance, social media, of course, mainstream media, how it all is collectivism, the Prussian education system, we're going to touch on that a bit, advertising, social conditioning, and oaths, and voting, and flags. Yay. Again, one more time, 347-855-8301. Press 1 to participate if you want to call in. Going to roll out the intro. We'll be back in a sec.
There's something wrong. You don't know what it is, but it's there. Like a splinter in your mind. You have to see it for yourself. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth. Like a splinter in your mind. Tumbling down the rabbit hole. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Like a splinter. All I'm offering is the truth.
Yes, all I'm offering is the truth. And I want to start the show with a quote from Edward Bernays from his book Propaganda from 1928. The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. We are governed, our minds are molded, our tastes formed, our ideas suggested, largely by men we have never heard of. This is a logical result in the way in which our democratic society is organized. Again, that was Edward Bernays from his book Propaganda from 1928. I want to really start off with the more you know, the post, the picture, the promo for this show discussing the Pledge of Allegiance. The Pledge of Allegiance was actually developed by a guy named Francis Bellamy. He was a big-time socialist. He was hired by James B. Upham. James B. Upham needed a way to sell more issues of his magazine, The Youth Companion. The pledge was conceived as a way to promote nationalism in order to sell flags to schools as a premium to solicit subscriptions. The recital was accompanied with a salute which was basically a Hitler salute. It was later replaced with a hand over the heart gesture. But yeah, it was a Hitler salute at the time. And really, tying back into Bernays and manipulation Actually, the Pledge of Allegiance was a form of advertising. It was an advertising for the Youth's Companion, James Upham's company. They promoted nationalism in order to sell flags to schools to solicit subscriptions to the Youth Companion. Now you know. Pretty interesting. Pretty interesting that you know that. And holy moly, I got 336. I think I know who this is. Has their hand up. We're going to bring them in.
Hey, all 336. I started digging deep into the Constitution and everything. I was reading. They broke everything. The Democratic Party's against the Constitution because one party was in the Constitution. That's what it says. When they formed a Democratic Party, they ripped the Constitution to shreds. When slavery started in the 1800s, they ripped the Constitution. When the Federal Reserve established it, it was against the Constitution.
Well, hold on, Brandon. Slavery, there were slaves from the very beginning. It was way past 1800s. There were slaves in the 1700s. When the founding fathers, and I use that term loosely, were most of them were Masonic, Freemason slave owners.
This whole thing's nothing but an illusion. Since the beginning,
that's the point I'm trying to make is we're gonna break down a bunch of these rituals, these statist rituals, and I'm gonna show how their indoctrination, their brainwashing, it's all collectivism. And basically, it's advertising. These are all different ways to advertise for the corporation of the United States. Yes, the United States is a corporation. I wanted to get into this. I wanted to get further. Right. I wanted to get further into the Pledge of Allegiance. I've got a little bit more tidbits on that. Let me pull that up. I've got it all set up here for my show. I got everything laid out. Give me just a second, guys. The history of the Pledge of Allegiance. I'm gonna go through the history and the changes. This is from ushistory.org. We're gonna talk about the Pledge of Allegiance. The Pledge of Allegiance was written in August 1892. I'm going to turn down the speaker so I don't have anything blowing in, any advertising. By the socialist minister, socialist and minister, Francis Bellamy. He was born in 1855, deceased 1931. It was originally published in the Youth's Companion on September 8, 1892. Bellamy had hoped that the pledge would be used by citizens in any country. So he didn't write it just for the United States of America. He wrote it as an indoctrination tool and mechanism, basically to be used worldwide. Everyone knows it. I pledge allegiance. Here's the original. In its original form, it read, I pledge allegiance to my flag and the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Then in 1923, the words, the flag of the United States of America, were added. At this time, it read, you got background noise. Can you turn that down?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm at the racetrack.
You're at the racetrack?
Yeah, I've been dying to come on your show so I can expose some stuff that I've read. Everything I've been digging into.
Well, we're gonna get to that. Hold on, we're gonna get to that. I wanna go through the crux of this show is I wanna talk about these statism rituals. And in 1923, the words "the flag of the United States," as I stated, were added. At this time, it read, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Then in 1954, in response to the communist threats of the time, President Eisenhower encouraged Congress to add the words under God, creating the 31-word pledge we say today. Bellamy's daughter objected to this alteration. Today it reads, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Now, you can get into this. Section 4 of the flag code states, yes, there is a flag code for a pledging to a piece of cloth. We're going to get into that. Section 4 of the flag code states, pledge of allegiance to the flag. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all, should be rendered by standing at attention, facing the flag with the right hand over the heart. When not in uniform, men should remove any non-religious headdresses with their right hand and hold it at the left shoulder, the hand being over the heart. Persons in uniform should remain silent, face the flag, and render the military salute. Interesting. I'll bring you back. The original Bellamy salute, first described in 1892 by Francis Bellamy, who authored the original pledge, began with the military salute, the Sieg Heil salute. And after reciting started with the military salute, that's the hand over the forehead, and after reciting the words to the flag, the arm was extended toward the flag, giving the old Sieg Heil, or the Heil Hitler salute. At a signal from the principal, the pupils in ordered ranks, hands to side, face to the flag, another signal is given. Every pupil gives the flag a military salute, right hand lifted, palm outward, to align with the forehead and close to it. Standing thus, all repeat together slowly, I pledge allegiance to my flag and the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. At the words, to my flag, the right hand is extended gracefully, palm upward. Oh, okay, so it's not the Sieg Heil, the palm upward, and remain in this gesture till the end of the affirmation, whereupon all hands immediately drop to the side. That's from the Youth Companion, 1892. In World War II, the salute too much resembled the Nazi salute, so it was changed to keep the right hand over the heart throughout. Yeah, they didn't want it to look like they were doing the Sieg Heil salute or the history salute. I also wanted to get into this. There's some strange history behind the Pledge of Allegiance. This is pretty interesting. This is by Kelly Marshall from September 15, 2015. It's from the TPM Cafe. I walked into the one-room schoolhouse just as the schoolmaster was leading the children in the Pledge of Allegiance. Face the flag with your right hand over your heart, and then we say, my flag, raise your arm in the air, like so. The 20 children, ranging in age from 5 to 13 and decked out in Little House on the Prairie attire, obeyed. With hands over their hearts, they pivoted toward the American flag in the corner of the room and began, making sure to extend their right arms when uttering the expression, my flag. What? Along with my family, I'm visiting a reconstructed 1840 schoolhouse on the outskirts of Chicago, in which volunteers recreate a typical morning of instruction. In here, the year is 1893. Grover Cleveland is president, and the Pledge of Allegiance is barely a year old. And you've likely deduced, quite different from the one most Americans speak today. In fact, what you'll also notice as you further read is the pledge, like virtually all writing and art, reflects more about America as well as its fears at certain moments in history than a stable verbal vow of duty to one's country and schoolroom. I already covered the basic Bellamy pledge, but in 1892, 37-year-old socialist minister Francis Bellamy pens the Pledge of Allegiance as part of a national patriotic school program, which would coincide with the opening of the Columbian Exposition in Chicago. The plan was for school children across the country to recite in unison this new promise to the American flag. I'm going to read that again. The plan was for school children across the country to recite in unison this new promise to the American flag, to a piece of cloth. If you search online for information about the creation of the Pledge of Allegiance, this is mostly what you find. Basic information about Bellamy and the Chicago World's Fair of 1893, but a deeper search reveals a far more xenophobic history. In his book, To the Flag, The Unlikely History of the Pledge of Allegiance, Richard J. Ellis digs further into the nation's patriotic school program of 1892. Ellis writes that the creation of the pledge actually reflected two widespread anxieties among native-born Americans. At the time, the fear of new immigrants, especially in the Northeast, and the complacency of the post-Civil War Americans oblivious to the dangers facing the country. Bellamy's new pledge, then, would serve two purposes, Ellis argues: to rekindle the patriotism and heroic duty of the Civil War years, and to Americanize the foreigner. Now, in 1923, the pronoun my was dropped from the Pledge of Allegiance and the words the flag of the United States were added. This added clarity for the immigrants. During the first National Flag Conference, yes, they have a National Flag Conference, the American Legion and the Daughters of the American Revolution made this change so that immigrant children who could theoretically be pledging their native land rather than the U.S. as they spoke would be clear as to which flag they were saluting. The following year, the National Flag Conference would further refine the pledge for the same reason, this time adding the words of America. Let's rethink that salute. That's from the 30s. Again, in his book, To the Flag, The Unlikely History of the Pledge of Allegiance, Richard J. Ellis explains that by the mid-30s, Americans had noticed an eerie similarities between the Bellamy salute and the Heil Hitler salute. Then with the onset of World War II, some women's clubs, parent and teacher organizations, the Red Cross, and the Boys and Girl Scouts, for example, more vocally expressed their concerns about the parallels. So they're worried about saluting and pledging to a piece of cloth. The way they did it looked too much like they were saluting Hitler. Some schools even revised the salute on their own. Ellis reports that in September 1939, an elementary school in New Jersey required children to leave their hands on their hearts throughout the pledge. Finally, by February 1942, some schools had altogether replaced the arm extended salute in favor of the army salute. Hearts, not Hitler, 1942. with the growing concern about American citizens being mistaken for Nazi sympathizers, the Bellamy salute was officially done away with in December of 1942. Congress passed an amended flag code, decreeing the Pledge of Allegiance should be rendered by standing at attention facing the flag with the right hand over the heart. Then back in 1954, the Pledge of Allegiance underwent another change, responding to the threat of Soviet communism, again more national fear. President Eisenhower encouraged Congress to add the words "under God" to the pledge. This, he declared, would reaffirm the transcendence of religious faith in America's heritage and future, and strengthen those spiritual weapons which forever will be our country's most powerful resource in peace and war. So in 1944, the amendment would create the pledge that most Americans say today. Between these major alterations to America's Pledge of Allegiance are other cases. For example, Jehovah's Witnesses that have argued that reciting the pledge violated their prohibition against venerating a graven image, and which I actually agree to. I mean, it you are paying, you know, it's a graven image. It's a false idol. In 1943, the Supreme Court ruled in their favor. Moreover, atheists and advocates of religious tolerance have long spoken out about the addition of the phrase "under God" to the pledge, as this reference to a single deity does not work for Buddhists, Zoroastrians, or Hindus. One of the most recent public cases involves a New Jersey high school student. For more on these movements, see the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberties pledge cases. So next time you hear someone express his or her opinion about the Pledge of Allegiance and stating we cannot alter the pledge, no one can take out of it, you will know how, based on history, best to respond. So that pretty much breaks it down for you guys. I mean, the pledge, again, I'm going to reiterate, started out as advertising for the Youth Companion. That's all it was. And it's morphed into this thing now that if you don't, you know, pledge allegiance, and I mean, for years, I mean, when I was a kid in school, I was forced to pledge allegiance to the flag. I mean, now we get, you know, you pledge allegiance to a flag. To a flag, to a piece of cloth. It's pretty insane. The next point I want to get into and I want to talk about is the Star Spangled Banner. Yes. That is the song, the national anthem of the United States of America. The Star Spangled Banner is the national anthem of the United States of America. The lyrics come from Defense of Fort McHenry. This is a poem written on September 14, 1814, by the 35-year-old lawyer and amateur poet Francis Scott Key, after witnessing the bombardment of Fort McHenry by British ships of the Royal Navy in Baltimore Harbor during the Battle of Baltimore in the War of 1812. Key was inspired by the large American flag, the Star-Spangled Banner, flying triumphantly above the fort during the American victory. The poem was set to the tune of a popular British song written by John Stafford Smith for the Anachronic Society, a men's social club in London, to Anacreon in Heaven, or the Anacreonic Song, with various lyrics, was already popular in the United States. Set to Key's poem and renamed the Star-Spangled Banner, it soon became a well-known American patriotic song. with a range of 1 octave and 1/5, a semitone more than 1.5 octaves. It is known for being difficult to sing, although the poem has 4 stanzas. Only the first is commonly sung today. Star Spangled Banner, the national anthem. Yeah, I mean, you know, the Corporation of the United States of America has got, I mean, you got to have a song, right? I mean, advertising, baby. The Star Spangled Banner was recognized for official use by the United States Navy in 1889 and by U.S. President Woodrow Wilson in 1916. It was made the national anthem by a congressional resolution on March 3, 1931. As codified at 36 U.S.C. at 301, which was signed by Herbert Hoover. Before 1931, we had other songs that served as hymns of the American official idiom. Hail Columbia served this purpose at official functions for most of the 19th century. Then the good old My Country, 'Tis of Thee, whose melody is identical to God Save the Queen, the British national anthem. Yeah, the Brits, the status Brits, they have their rituals too. Also served as a de facto anthem. Following the War of 1812 and subsequent American wars, other songs emerged to compete for popularity at public events. Among them, the Star Spangled Banner and, of course, you can't forget America the Beautiful. I wanted to get into the Star Spangled Banner and Francis Scott Key and his lyrics. I'm going to read the entire Star Spangled Banner. You only hear the first verse, but I'm going to read the entire thing to you as it was written by Francis Scott Key, and I want you to listen. It's "Oh Say Can You See by the Dawn's Early Light, what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous flight, or the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh say does that star-spangled banner yet wave, o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave." I'm going to read the rest. That's all you ever hear. And remember, they gave Colin Kaepernick a bunch of grief for not standing to this anthem, to this song. If you read further, "On the shore dimly seen through the mists of the deep, where the foe's haughty host in dread silence reposes, what is that which the breeze o'er the towering steep, as it fitfully blows, half conceals, half discloses? Now it catches the gleam of the morning's first beam, in full glory reflected, now shines in the stream. 'Tis the star-spangled banner, oh, long may it wave, o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave." And then this is the part that people don't even know is in there. This is the part talking about keeping the slaves in line. "And where is the band so valiantly swore that the havoc of war and the battle's confusion, a home and a country, should leave us no more? For blood has washed out their foul footsteps' pollution. No refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave. And the star-spangled banner in triumph doth wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave." So basically, what this is stating is this was, make sure to keep the slaves and all your hirelings in line. There is no refuge to save them. And then the fourth stanza, which you never hear, is, "Oh, thus be it ever where free men shall stand between their loved home and the war's desolation. Blessed with victory and peace, may the heaven rescued land praise the power that hath made and preserved us a nation. Then conquer we must when our cause it is just, and this be our motto, in God is our trust. And the star-spangled banner in triumph shall wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave." Now you know the rest of the story. Now you can understand why Colin Kaepernick had problem standing for this anthem and pledging, and, you know, I mean, standing for this anthem. Talking about keeping the slaves in line. I don't blame the guy a bit. And now you know the rest of the story about the Star Spangled Banner, the magical song, the national anthem. Yeah, we're covering these little statism and statist rituals. So first we've covered the proper way to pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth, the flag. Now we've covered the real meaning behind the Star Spangled Banner. Oh yeah, and the pledge of the piece of cloth started out as advertising to sell flags in schools and to sell subscription to the Youth Companion, a magazine in 1892. The other thing we covered is the anthem and all these different songs that represent America. For what that's worth, I mean, it's America is a piece of ground, but you do these rituals and you basically create and reinforce this statism. It's a religion. These are rituals in a religion. That's all these really are. I want to go on further. One other thing, I'm going to talk about the nine things you may not know about the Star Spangled Banner. This is from September 12, 2014 by Christopher Klein. This is from History Stories, based, you know, this is a blog from the History Channel. And then the first thing that you wanted to learn about is Francis Scott Key intended his verses to be song lyrics, not poetry. Key was an amateur poet, not a songwriter. He intended them to accompany a popular song of the day. We know he had this tune in mind because the rhyme and meter exactly fit it. The first broadside of the verses, as again I covered this, was to an acronym to heaven. Key was familiar with the tune, having used it to accompany an 1805 poem, which included a reference to Star Spangled Flag, which he had written to honor Barbary War naval heroes Stephen Decatur and Charles Stewart. Although Key composed the patriotic lyrics amid a burst of anti-British euphoria, "To Anacreon in Heaven" was ironically an English song composed in 1775 that served as the theme song of the upper crust Anacreonic Society of London and a popular pub stable. Number two, everyone says Francis Scott Key was in prison and was looking out when he wrote this. He was imprisoned on a British warship. He wasn't. In his capacity as a Washington, D.C. lawyer, Key had been dispatched by President James Madison on a mission to Baltimore to negotiate for the release of Dr. William Beanes, a prominent surgeon captured at the Battle of Bladensburg. accompanied by John Stewart Skinner, a fellow lawyer working for the State Department. Key set sail on an American sloop in Baltimore Harbor, and on September 7, the pair boarded the British ship Ponant, where they dined and secured the prisoner's release under one condition. They could not go ashore until after the British attacked Baltimore. Accompanied by British guards on September 10, he returned to the American sloop from which he witnessed the bombardment behind the 50-ship British fleet. But I mean, it sounds better to have Francis Scott Key, you know, be imprisoned in a British warship, and he pens a verses. I mean, that gives the ritual a deeper meaning. And the number three, the flag Key hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, did not fly through the perilous flight. In addition to a thunderstorm of bombs, a torrent of rain fell on Fort McHenry throughout the night in the Battle of Baltimore. The fort's 30-by-42-foot garrison flag was so massive that it required 11 men to hoist it when dry. And if waterlogged, the woolen banner could have weighed upwards of 500 pounds and snapped the flagpole. So as rain poured down, a smaller storm flag that measured 17-by-25 feet flew in its place. In the morning, they most likely took down the rain-soaked storm flag and hoisted the bigger one, Leibson said. And that's the flag Key saw in the morning. Number four, the song was not originally entitled The Star-Spangled Banner. When Key scrawled his lyrics on the back of a letter he pulled from his pocket on the morning of September 14, he did not give them any title. Within a week, Key's verses were printed on broadsides in Baltimore newspapers under the title Defense of Fort McHenry. In November, a Baltimore music store printed the patriotic song with sheet music for the first time under the more lyrical title, The Star-Spangled Banner. Number five, this is interesting too. It did not become the national anthem until more than a century after it was written. Along with Hail Columbia and Yankee Doodle, the Star-Spangled Banner was among the prevalent patriotic airs in the aftermath of the War of 1812. During the Civil War, the Star-Spangled Banner was an anthem for Union troops, and the song increased in popularity in the ensuing decades, which led President Woodrow Wilson to sign an executive order in 1916 designating it as the national anthem of the United States for all military ceremonies. On March 3, 1931, after 40 previous attempts fails, a measure passed Congress and was signed into law formally designated the Star-Spangled Banner as the national anthem of the United States. Number six is the national anthem has four verses. We covered that. And number seven, he opposed entry into the War of 1812. Ironically, the man who created one of the lasting patriotic legacies of the War of 1812 adamantly opposed the conflict at its outset. He referred to the war as abominable and a lump of wickedness. However, his opposition to the war softened after British began to raid nearby Chesapeake Bay communities in 1813 and 1814. And he briefly served in a Georgetown wartime militia. And number eight, Key was a consummate Washington insider. Although Key loathed politics, he was a prominent figure in Washington, D.C. He was an important player in the early Republic, Leibson says. He was a very successful and influential lawyer at the highest levels in Washington. Key ran a thriving law practice, served as a trusted advisor in Andrew Jackson's kitchen cabinet, and was appointed a United States attorney in 1833. He prosecuted hundreds of cases, including that of Richard Lawrence for the attempted assassination of Jackson, and argued over 100 cases for the United States Supreme Court. Little background. Oh, we've got, these are always interesting. I'm going to bring in this unlisted caller.
What's up, Austin?
Hey, unknown caller.
How you doing?
Who's
this? Joe. This is Joe.
Hey, Joe.
Montana.
Oh, Joe, I haven't heard from you in a while. How you doing, buddy?
Not bad, not bad. I've been listening to the show and talking about Bernays and talking about the influence of the Star Spangled Banner and how it's part of propaganda. Do you have any modern day symbols, like from 1920 onward, that have captivated the minds of our children or captivated the minds of our voters coming up in the program?
Yeah, I might be getting into that. I mean, I basically broke it down. Next, I was going to get into the next status ritual. I was going to talk about voting, but if you want to interject, by all means, any other propaganda pieces and status ritualistic things, you're welcome to chime in. Do you got anything in mind?
No, nothing specifically, because I was listening to your story about the Star Spangled Banner and how the kids were taught to put the hands over
their
hearts.
Well, that's the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance.
Right.
And, you know,
yeah.
Absolutely, because, you know, the more that you stand up and pledge allegiance to the flag, and that's an everyday ritual, then the more you become part of the state. And the state is taking the moldable minds of children and teaching them whatever they want to teach them. You know, and that's the public school education. And I think, I don't know if I mentioned this on your show before, but everybody knows, or people who do know about logic appreciate its significance. And then when you take a look at logic and you know that it's a formal type of process, it's not just something which is taken out of somebody's lower rectum, then you have to ask yourself,
right.
and this is in relation to the public school system. If the public school system is there to help teach us how to think, and if logic is the mainframe, the mainstay, the fulcrum from which one learns how to think, then why isn't there, as far as I know, in any high school facility, in any high school at all, why isn't logic part of a formalized course?
Well, I can give you some of that. That ties into what I talked about earlier,
uh-huh.
And it ties into this Prussian education system that became part of the United States in the 1800s, well, late 1700s to be more precise, where actual, as it expanded, actual critical thinking was frowned upon because it's collective rote memorization. The system is basically conformity, collectivism, and patriotism and
right.
nationalism. This is what's taught in, well, I'm using the term taught loosely. This is the propaganda that the kids get in the Prussian school system, Prussian education system. And now it's even getting worse with this Common Core nonsense.
The Common Core. And that answers the question about why it's not taught. Because if the public school system were taking its responsibilities seriously, it would teach reading, writing, arithmetic, and logic, and critical thinking, so that the normal average kid could grow up to be a responsible, self-sufficient, thinking human. But they don't want that.
Right.
They want what you're talking about, collectivism, statism, conformity, the matrix. Everybody thinks that they have a free will, but they don't really, because as you were talking about at the beginning of the program, you were talking about Bernays and propaganda. And this is how,
right.
like Stalin said, give me your youth, and I'll conquer your country.
Well, exactly. I mean, start them young. I mean, that's why. I mean, you're 6, 7 years old. You're in first, second grade, and you're pledging allegiance to a piece of cloth.
Mm-hmm. Yep, you're pledging allegiance to the ideal that America, love it or leave it, which created a conflict, especially during the Vietnam War, where when people who were draft dodgers and who didn't want to go over to Vietnam, they were criticized and exiled practically because this is our country, love it or leave it. Or even as recently as the Iraq War, if you remember the pundits on TV, I think, Joe Scarborough or one of those, both of those pundits, they were saying, you know, oh, yes, and O'Reilly was saying, now it's time, since President Bush had gotten us into the war, it's time to end all debate and just support your president. No.
Right. Yeah, just, you know, we're going to go to Iraq and Afghanistan to fight terrorism, but the terrorist attack that happened in the United States was basically a bunch of radical Wahhabi Saudis, but we're just going to sweep that under the rug because they're our buddies, right? They're our OPEC buddies.
Mm-hmm.
We're just going to sweep that under the rug, and we're gonna go for maintenance of the petrodollar, and we're gonna go bomb a bunch of brown people in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna kill a bunch of people there because Saddam Hussein is a crazy guy, and he's, you know, abusing and killing his people. So we're gonna go in there and kill more people than he'd ever dream of.
Yeah.
To liberate them.
Yeah, to liberate them and to give them democracy, which, of course, they didn't ask for. And if they really wanted democracy, they would have established it themselves or would have brought over somebody from England or from America as consultants in order to show them how to do it. But no, we got to go over there and we have to teach them by banging them over the head and shooting their mothers and their fathers and their children that democracy is wonderful. Hey,
right, exactly.
God. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the American way. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light?
Yeah, and
that goes into the last verse of the national anthem that you never
you were
hear
that. Yeah,
about conquest.
Yeah,
it talks about American conquest.
Yeah, I heard that the conquering. You're talking about the slaves and the underlings. I have a world history book. It was published in 1935 or 55, I believe. And I have it, and I kept it. And you know that in the book, and it's published in New York City, it's right here in America, and it's talking about imperialism. And it says very, very clearly, I think, in a few, you know, I don't know how many chapters were devoted to it, but it says very, very clearly that the United States of America was is an imperialistic nation back at the time of 1955. You won't see that anymore
in the
history book.
well, no, because I mean, that doesn't fit the agenda. Again, that doesn't fit the agenda of what's going on today. I mean, today, you know, you praise to a, and what really cracks me up is probably half the flags that you're praising are made in China anyway.
China.
I just want to point out to the listeners and hopefully have some more that are constitutionalists,
mm-hmm.
you know, and things of that nature. I'm going to get into the Constitution, and I'm going to get into voting, too, these other status rituals. I'm going to get into representation and representatives.
Oh, good.
And I'm just laying out facts. All the links are, all the links are posted in the show promo. I mean, I'm not making this stuff up. This is all actual facts. I just want to bring it to the forefront because people are guided by feels anymore. They don't use analytical thinking and logic. It's all feel good.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, oh, say, can you see? And you know, I just got kicked out of the deplorables group. That's a Trumpster supporting group.
Wait a minute.
Because
that's the Trump supporters.
Yeah, the deplorables, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that collectivist, populist group, you know, that follow the Trumpster's cult of personality, that group. I got kicked out of there.
Mm.
The main reason I was called a piece of shit because I defended Colin Kaepernick.
Well, I heard you would, you said you didn't blame him at all because of the stanzas within the Pledge of Allegiance that supported slavery, yeah.
Right. Yeah, it supports keeping the slaves down, and if they dare to escape, kill them.
Oh, did you know that at the one time they esteemed, I don't think they had a psychiatric institution at the time of slavery, but they were, you know, authority figures who came up with the idea and made it official that slaves that ran away from the plantation, they did so because they were suffering from neurosis.
They were suffering from what?
Neurosis. They had a mental...
Oh, neurosis, psychosis, yeah. They're crazy for trying to escape being whipped and beat and worked.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, that's crazy thinking.
They want liberty. They want liberty? What's wrong with these people?
Yeah. Huh?
Oh, God, it's amazing. You know, I used to be proud to be an American, and then I used to be glad that I was an American. And now I guess I'm just glad that the communists haven't fully taken over yet.
Sorry about that delay there. I had to let the dogs in and put the phone on mute, yell at my dogs to come in. Yep. That's the beauty of doing a talk show, a blog talk. You hang out here at the home on the computer.
Yeah.
Got to go outside and smoke a cigarette. I know that's a bad habit, but hey, you know, I guess I'm free to do that.
Well, for
waiting
now.
For,
oh, you're
waiting
right.
For,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
For now.
Yeah.
But they sure tax the heck out of those tobacco sticks, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, you know what? I was listening to a show. I think it was earlier this morning where people were talking about the property taxes that they had to pay for their homes, and they were talking about how when they bought their home about 20 years ago, the home that they bought cost less than the property taxes they're paying today.
Right. Yeah, but remember, you own your home.
Yeah, you own your home as long as the government says an endangered frog is nearby. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Stick around
for the next hour, Joe. I'm going to put you on hold. I'm going to pull up the ads here. I'm going to play some ads. Thank our sponsors, of course.
Sure.
And I want to put a shout out to my good friend that works for Dabco Transportation, Earl Conlin, one of our sponsors from the very beginning here at Truth Emerges. He's bringing the Dashboard Outlaw back. We're going to sort out the details. He'll be back in a week or two. Stick around, folks. We're going to take a little quick commercial break, thank our sponsors, promote our shows. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Hang tough.
Well, I pulled out of Pittsburgh, rolling down that eastern seaboard. I got my diesel wound up and she's running like I never before.
Hey folks, this is The Mouth, and if you need something moved, you need to go through Dabco Transportation. Family owned and operated, Dabco Transportation specializes in pad wrap fixtures to retail stores throughout the country, as well as furniture transportation, pad trap and box furniture from California to Arizona to all points east. be it truckload, LTL, rollout, exclusive use, or expedited, Dabco is here to service their clients safely, efficiently, and quickly. So if you need something moved within the continental U.S., contact Dabco Transportation at 609-296-9121 or contact them directly at dabcotrans.com. That's dabcotrans.com. But I can never make believe it's all right. 6 days on the road and I'm gonna make it home tonight. This is an historic moment. We have in this past year made great progress in ending the long era of conflict and Cold War. We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order. A world where the rule of law, not the law of the jungle, governs the conduct of nations. When we are successful, and we will be, we have a real chance at this new world order, an order in which a credible United Nations can use its peacekeeping role to fulfill the promise and vision of the UN standards. This is an historic moment. When we are successful, we will be a new world order.
The one and only original Gorilla Radio with Austin Thomas and Liberty Lisa. Wednesdays, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Only on the Truth Emerges Radio Network.
A new world order, an order in which a credible United Nations can use its peacekeeping role to fulfill the promise and vision of the UN's founders.
Easy money. Easy money.
Who is getting your money? If you are being hijacked by corruption in your government, you will quickly realize that you are stuck with no way out. Find out how your life, family, and assets can be stolen from you while you are the one paying for it. Join me, Debbie Carroll, at the Fourth Branch, The Truth Emerges, on Blog Talk Radio, Thursday nights from 6 to 8 Pacific Time. We need everyone on board to understand what is happening and put a stop to this evil corruption.
You're listening to Unraveling the Matrix with Austin Thomas. Join the second hour by calling 1-347-855-8301.
All right, everybody, back here on Unraveling the Matrix. Thanks for sticking around. I'll bring my buddy Joe back in. Hey, Joe,
hey,
you're back.
All righty. Yeah.
The next
you know
thing
what?
I want to talk about is statist rituals. Let's talk about voting. How about that, Joe?
Yeah, that's the best ritual of all. That's the one that, in my opinion, exemplifies just how deeply enmeshed in the Matrix people are.
Right. I want to start out with who was originally allowed to vote in America. The United States Constitution did not originally define who was eligible to vote, allowing each state to determine who was eligible. In the early history of the U.S., most states allowed only white male adult property owners to vote. Freed slaves could vote in four states. And then we're going to talk about how we used to vote. This is interesting, too. This thing will come up. My computer's moving like in slow motion. Let's spit it out. Quit loading. All right, we're going to talk about... This is from the New Yorker, October 13, 2008. It's the Annals of Democracy, How We Used to Vote by Jill Lepore. On the morning of November 2nd, 1859 election date, George Kyle, a merchant with the Baltimore firm of Dinsmore and Kyle, left his house with a bundle of ballots tucked under his arm. Kyle was a Democrat. As he neared the polls in the city's 15th ward, which was heavily dominated by the American Party, a ruffian tried to snatch his ballots. Kyle dodged and wheeled and heard a cry. His brother just next to him had been struck. Next, someone clobbered Kyle, who drew a knife but didn't get a chance to use it. "I felt a pistol put to my head," he said. Grazed by the bullet, he fell. When he rose, he drew his own pistol hidden in his pocket. He spied his brother lying in the street. Someone else fired a shot, hitting Kyle in the arm. A man carrying a musket rushed at him. Another threw a brick, knocking him off his feet. George Kyle picked himself up and ran. He never did cast his vote, nor did his brother, who died of his wounds. The Democratic candidate for Congress, William Harrison, lost the American Party's Henry Winter Davis. 3 months later, when the House of Representatives convened hearings into the election, whose result Harrison contested, Davis's victory was upheld on the ground that any man of ordinary courage could have made his way to the polls. Voting in America, it's fair to say, used to be different. Are you not a man in full vigor of manhood and strength, a member of Congress, of the House Committee of Elections, asked another Harrison supporter who, like Kyle, went to the polls but turned back without voting, and who happened to stand 6 feet and weighed more than 200 pounds. The hearings established a precedent. To vacate an election law textbook subsequently advised, it must clearly appear that there was a display of force as ought to have intimidated men of ordinary firmness. What was at stake in the House of Committee on Elections was whether men like George Kyle were too easily daunted. What wasn't at stake was that Kyle, an ordinary voter, carried with him to the poll a bundle of that ballots. Nowhere in the United States in 1859 did election officials provide ballots. Kyle, like everybody else, brought his own. The ballots he carried, pre-printed party tickets, endorsed the slate of Democratic candidates headed by Harrison. Voters got their ballots either from a partisan at the polls or at home or by cutting them out of a newspaper. Then they had to cross through the throngs to climb a platform placed against the wall of a building. Voters weren't allowed inside, and pass their ballots through a window and into the hands of an election judge. This was no mean feat, and not only in Baltimore. In the middle of decades of the 19th century, 89 Americans were killed at the polls during Election Day riots. So there was nothing to document how many times you could vote, what kind of poll you got, and like this guy right here, he's bringing, I don't know, hundreds of ballots to keep stuffing through there. The reform that ended this unsettling state of affairs was imported from Australia and was not achieved in the United States until the 1890s. The American adoption of the Australian ballot and the radical idea that governments should provide ballots was hard fought. It lies, if long forgotten, behind every argument about how we ought to vote now, from the 2002 Help America Vote Act's promotion of paperless voting to the more recent backlash favoring a paper trail. And it is also, like every other American election reform, a patch upon a patch. The United States was founded as an experiment in the 18th century republicanism, which it was understood that only men with property would vote, and publicly, since they were the only people who could be trusted to vote on the commonweal and not private gain in mind. What went on in 1859 was something altogether different. Voting was still public, but all white men could vote, and nearly 70% of them managed to do so in the congressional elections that year, pistols and fisticuffs notwithstanding. From an 18th century point of view, how we vote now looks even stranger. Casting a ballot remains the defining act of American citizenship. But especially since the election of 2000, with its precariously hanging Chad, many people worry that voting in America is in shambles and even a sham, and that the machinery of our democracy is broken, crippled by confusing, ineligible, and deceptive ballots, vote counting devices either rickety and outdated or new gimmicky and untested, but in any case, unreliable and by no means tamper-proof, and a near-total absence of national standards and federal oversight. In this fall's presidential election, every citizen who is 18 or older, except in some states, prisoners and felons, will be eligible to vote. Somewhat more than half of us will turn up. We won't be clobbered, stabbed, or shot. We will not even have to bring our own ballots. We will insist that how we vote be secret. The founders didn't plan for this. No one planned for it. There is no plan. It's patches all the way down. So back in the day, when you voted, you could vote as many times as you want. You had to bring your own ballot, and you didn't go into any room to vote. You stuffed them through a slot for a voting judge. What do you think of that, Joe? Ah, maybe I lost Joe. But this just shows the fallacy and the ritual of voting. Then I'm going to cover more on voting. There you are, Joe. What do you think of that craziness on how you used to vote?
Man, it was nuts. I was listening on speaker. It is nuts. You brought your own ballot. You ran the risk of being hijacked by highwaymen. The government didn't provide ballots. Excuse me. I actually have a solution to the ballot. It provides a paper trail, and at the same time takes advantage of all modern technology. What you do? You go to the polls. The pollster gives you your vote. You provide your vote on paper, but you get a receipt. You get your receipt back for what you voted. And
right
now, the receipt, the vote that you administered to the pollster, he has to put it up online so that you go online and you know that your vote is counted. So you've got a receipt, you go online, you find out, and this is a secret vote. You get the receipt number, you go online, you find out, you check out the receipt number online, and that way you know that all the votes are counted honestly, because everybody will go online to make sure that their vote is there. You've got the receipt, you got a paper trail, you've got the electronic voting machine being employed, and you go online to find out to make sure that your vote is actually being counted the way that you want it to.
Interesting. So you have your receipt, you go there, you check your receipt, and if it's different than you voted online, what would be the recourse if your vote wasn't tallied properly?
Then you go to the authorities and you let them know, the FEC, and you let them know, hey, I've got the receipt that shows who I voted for. It's not up online. It shows a different vote. It doesn't show that you voted for it, but it shows, let's say, if you wanted to vote for Trump or whoever, let Larkin Rose. So if you voted for Larkin, right, then it shows that receipt number 456 voted for Larkin Rose. You know that you're 456. You voted for Larkin Rose. Bang. You've got the paper trail. and you've got the proof that you voted, and you've got the proof of whom you voted for, and it's right there online for people to see without violating your privacy.
Right. That's interesting. But I mean, for voter reform, something like that would be too logical. I mean, you know,
hell
how,
yeah.
How could all these dead people vote? Well, I guess the dead people could still vote because they wouldn't be checking online to validate their vote.
No, yeah, they would check online for the graveyard. If they're in the graveyard, then you know that they voted and their vote counts.
And another status ritual or statism ritual that I want to discuss is, now that we've talked about voting and this thing where you elect, what do you elect? You elect a legislator who comes up with legislation. We're going to start with the legislation and then we're going to get into legislators. Legislation is a noun. What it is, it's laws considered collectively tax legislation. Synonyms are laws, bodies of laws, rules, rulings, regulations, acts, bills, statutes, enactments, and ordinances. Legislation, we're going to go into good old Wikipedia. Legislation, or statutory law, is a law which has been promulgated or enacted by a legislature or other governing body or the process of making it. Before an item of legislation becomes law, it may be known as a bill and may be broadly referenced to as legislation. While it remains under consideration to distinguish it from other business, legislation can have many purposes: to regulate, to authorize, to outlaw, to provide funds, to sanction, to grant, to declare or restrict. It may be contrasted with non-legislative act, which is adopted by an executive or administrative body under the authority of a legislative act for implementation of a legislative act. Under the Westminster system, an item of primary legislation known as an act of parliament after enactment. Legislation is usually proposed by a member of the legislature, i.e., a member of Congress or parliament, or by the executive, whereupon it is debated by members of the legislature and is often amended before passage. Most large legislatures enact only a small fraction of the bills proposed in a given session. Whether a given bill will be proposed is generally a matter of the legislative priorities of government. Legislation is regarded as one of the three main functions of government, which are often distinguished under the doctrine of the separation of powers. Those who have formal power to create legislation are known as legislators. A judicial branch of government will have the formal power to interpret the legislation, see statutory interpretation, and the executive branch of government can act only within the powers and limits set by law. That's funny. So you have your separation of powers. Those that have the formal power to create legislation are legislators. And then you have the judicial branch that interpret the legislation from the legislators. This sounds like a bunch of mumbo-jumbo ritualistic stuff to me for people that have believe that they're an authority to make laws and rules and regulations and to tell other people what to do. And then they have a judicial branch that interprets what they're telling people to do. And then the real funny part is when we talk about legislation, we got to talk about legislate tours. A legislator, plural noun legislators, a person who makes laws and is a member of a legislative body. Now we're going to go to Wikipedia to talk about legislators that you elect with your votes. A legislator or lawmaker is a person who writes and passes laws, especially someone who is a member of a legislature. Legislators are usually politicians and are often elected by the people of the state. Legislatures may be supranational, for example, the European Parliament, national, for example, the United States Congress, regional, for example, the National Assembly for Wales, or local, for example, local authorities. So, in essence, what you're doing, as we're discussing the statist rituals, what you're doing now is you're voting for a legislator to legislate, and the judicial branch interprets the legislation of the legislators or what they're telling everyone to do. Now, this all ties into another statist ritual, is called a representation. Now, representation, again, is a noun. There's a couple descriptions. The first definition is an action of speaking or acting on behalf of someone or the state of being so represented. Asylum seekers should be guaranteed good legal advice and representation. Number two is a description or portrayal of someone or something in a particular way or as being a certain nature. Then we're going to talk about representation and how and the fallacy on how you can elect someone to represent you through legislation. And how does this representative and this representation work if you didn't even vote for this person? How are they representing you? You look at it this way. Social representation is a stock of values, ideas, beliefs, and practices that are shared among members, groups, and communities. That's a social representation. But how does a representative represent you and come up with these laws and legislation? But technically, you are involved, I guess, because this we the people and you voted. But how are you involved if someone you didn't vote for comes up with legislation that you don't agree with, but it's mandated that you follow this legislation? Again, this is a total statist thing. That you could actually elect someone or vote for someone to represent you. I mean, it's the biggest fallacy of all. Then I'm gonna wrap it up and talk about how to properly retire an American flag and more on the flag. And this is the ultimate statist symbol and statist ritual. I mean, you tell me. Here's a breakdown. When an American flag becomes worn, faded, torn, or soiled, it should be retired and replaced with a new flag. There are several ways to respectfully dispose of the American flag without showing disgrace. I mean, you know, don't want to disgrace Chinese-made piece of cloth. The most common method is burning the torn or tattered flag in a special ceremony. Wow. So when your Chinese-made piece of colored cloth is worn out or torn or tattered, I guess the best way to retire it is to burn it with a totally statist ritualistic ceremony. I'm waiting for it to come up. My computer's been dragging. I don't know what's going on. We're gonna learn about the process on how to properly retire a flag. I thought we would, but there we go. This is from December 10th, 2012, collinsflags.com. Wholesale prices and dependable quality. This article is Flying Proud, How to Properly Retire an American Flag. When and how to retire an American flag respectfully, an easy step-by-step guide anyone can follow. The United States Flag Code, again, this more of this flag code, outlines proper flag etiquette for everything from properly folding a flag. So this Chinese-made piece of cloth, you have to fold it properly. To flying a flag correctly, you have to fly it correctly, too. I guess there's certain ways to fly the flag. It even describes in great detail how to retire an American flag respectfully. Let me click on this flag etiquette. Let's learn on proper flag etiquette, then I'll get back to that. On how to fold the flag and folding the flag properly and how to fly a flag properly. I mean, I guess it's more complicated than putting it on a flagpole and letting it flutter in the breeze. Campers are educated on flag etiquette. Oh, here's a nice picture. Guy saluting a folded piece of cloth. What does each flag fold rep mean? Okay, so there is 13 folds. And below, they explain what each of the fold means. Those who would disrespect our flag have never been handed a folded one. The first fold is a symbol of life. The second fold is for our belief in eternal life. The third fold is made in honor and remembrance of the veteran departing rank who gave a portion of his or her life for the defense of our country, to attain peace throughout the world. Okay, yeah. So you go to war to attain peace. Gotcha. The fourth fold stands for our weaker nature. As American citizens trusting in God, it's to Him we turn to in times of peace, as well as war, for His divine guidance. So God gives you guidance on how to kill other people that believe in God and are doing the same prayers to God. Gotcha. The fifth fold is a tribute to America. America is a piece of ground. It's a geographic location. In the words of Stephen Decatur, our country, in dealing with other countries, may she always be right, but it is still our country, right or wrong. So in other words, we should always be right, but if we're wrong, it doesn't matter. It's our country, right or wrong. Gotcha. The sixth fold is where our heart lies. It's with our flag that we pledge allegiance to the flag and the republic it stands for. The seventh fold is a tribute to our armed forces. For it is the armed forces that protect our country and flag. Protects our country and flag against enemies, whether they be domestic or foreign. So, yeah, I can understand protecting a geographic location, your country, but protecting the flag? Not so sure about that, whether they be foreign or domestic. And another thing is, How come we're protecting our country way out in the Middle East? How does that work? Got all these bases all around the world. How are we protecting our country over there? The eightfold is a tribute to the one who entered into the valley of the shadow of death, that we might see the light of day and to honor our mother for whom it flies on Mother's Day. The ninthfold is a tribute to womanhood, for it is through their faith, love, and loyalty and devotion to that the character of the men and women who have made this country great have been molded. The tenthfold is a tribute to Father. He has given his sons and daughters for the defense of our country since he or she was first born. The 11th fold, in the eyes of Hebrew citizens, represents the lower portion of the seal of King David and King Solomon and glorifies in their eyes the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The 12th fold, in the eyes of a Christian citizen, represents an emblem of eternity and glorifies in their eyes God the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. So the 12th fold in the flag, if you're a Christian citizen, represents the emblem of eternity and glorifies God. Got it. So you're glorifying God with with a false idol, but hey, what the hell? I mean, you know, let's play along. This is status rituals after all. When the flag is completely folded, which some consider the 13th fold, the stars and stripes are uppermost, reminding of us our national anthem, In God We Trust. Okay. Oh, and then you can learn here, too, on what size flag is right for my flagpole. So you got to have the right size flag and the right size flagpole. Every so often, comments pop up asking about flagpoles and flag sizes. We've decided to write a blog to help anyone asking the same question. The easiest way to determine which size flag to fly from your pole is first consider the height of your flagpole. The flag is usually at least 1/4 the height of the pole. The chart below is a minimum size suggestion for flags on your flagpole. Oh, geez. Oh, and then there's flag flying days, full and half-staff flag holidays. Every year there are special days the American flag flies either full or half-staff. To ensure you know which days these are, you are acknowledged for this company to sign up for their flag flying alerts. Our flag alerts send an email notification directly to your inbox on flag flying or half staff days. You can sign up for those alerts by clicking there. And then they give the breakdown of half staff days or Peace Officers Memorial Day. Memorial Day until noon, I guess afternoon, you bring it up to full staff. On Patriot Day, it flies half staff all day. And then on December 7th, Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day, you fly it at half staff. And then this is from 2016, they had a Firefighters Memorial Day rotating date in October, typically on a Sunday all day at half mast. And then you have your national flag holidays. New Year's Day is one. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, Lincoln's birthday, President's Day and Washington's birthday, Easter, Mother's Day, Armed Forces Day. And then, of course, the ultimate flag holiday, Flag Day. Then you have Father's Day, Independence Day, Labor Day, Patriot Day, National Prisoner of War Missing in Action Recognition Day, Columbus Day, Election Day, Veterans Day, and Thanksgiving Day. Holy moly. Oh, then you have 8 flags authorized to fly 24 hours a day because, you know, at nightfall you have to take your flag down and then put it back up. I mean, if you're following proper flag etiquette. Holy moly. This is amazing. Oh, then we're going to wrap it up here with when and how to retire an American flag respectfully. Here's your step-by-step guide that everyone can follow. It's the United States Flag Code outlines proper flag etiquette. We've gone into that. Folding a flag, we've gone into that. And it even describes in great detail on how to retire an American flag respectfully. So we got to retire a Chinese-made piece of cloth respectfully because it's an American flag because it has striped R's and is red, white, and blue. The U.S. Flag Code states that the flag, when it is in such condition that it is no longer a fitting emblem for display, should be destroyed in a dignified way, preferably by burning. Thus, when a flag is torn and tattered beyond repair, it is time to be retired. There was in Chicago this past June, there was a televised retirement ceremony for more than 7,000 flags. Oh, wow, they had a ceremony for 7,000 flags at once. The ceremony featured members of each branch of the military. Recently, Twin Falls Christian Academy principal Brett Walker held a ceremony to show students on how to properly retire old American flags. However, these are just two separate events of hundreds across the nation where members are respectfully retiring American flags. When an American flag becomes worn, torn, faded, or soiled, it should be retired and replaced with a new flag. There are several ways to respectfully dispose of the American flag without showing disgrace. The most common method is burning the torn or tattered flag in a special ceremony. So I guess, burning it is the sadist ritualistic way of disposing of a Chinese-made piece of colored cloth. Okay. The Veterans Department of Affairs suggests starting by folding the flag in the customary triangle manner. Don't forget your 13 folds and what each of those mean. Then prepare a large enough fire space to sufficiently burn the flag completely. Can't have any pieces of the flag left over. I mean, that would be disrespectful and all. Next, place the flag in the fire, and while it burns, individuals at the ceremony should salute or recite the Pledge of Allegiance. Oh, yeah, got to recite that Pledge of Allegiance. That was written by a socialist who was marketing to sell flags and was marketing for a magazine. Okay. Makes perfect sense. Seems legit. Next, place the flag in the fire while it burns. Individuals at the ceremony should salute or recite the Pledge of Allegiance. Why not do both? Finally, end the ceremony with a moment of silence and bury the ashes once the flag is completely consumed. Many groups that hold annual or semi-annual flag retirement ceremonies often have their own unique traditions they also follow. But these are the minimum steps everyone should at least follow when they retire an American flag. Oh, my. Oh, my. Wow. So make sure you do it right. The last thing I want to cover before I wrap this up is oaths and oath of office. These oaths are also a very big statist ritual. Now, when you are elected by the voting ritual, as a legislator, which is another ritual, you have to swear an oath to the Constitution, which is another statist ritual. Before he or she enters the execution of office, he shall take or she takes solemn oath or affirmation. I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will to the best of my ability preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. That is 5th U.S. Code 3331, Oath of Office. Now there is another one here. An individual except for the President, elected or appointed to an office of honor or profit in the civil service, uniform services, theirs is a little bit different. Let me see. Let me pull that one up for you. There is, I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which I am about to enter. So help me God. This section does not affect other oaths required by law. Okay. So, and the funny thing is, they usually swear this on a Bible. Bible freely speaks about bearing witness to false idols, which you are doing, and it's really confusing to me that you'd swear on a Bible, and the scriptures themselves talk about bearing witnesses to false idols. And I think the flag would be one of them. And then you take an oath of office to affirm a constitution. I don't know. I'm just confused. Boy, the status stuff is confusing. I'm going to wrap it up on that note. I am just thoroughly confused. And I think we pretty much covered all the status rituals well here in the geographic location of the United States of America. I mean, it's so obvious that statism is indoctrinated through the pledge, through this national anthem, through the Constitution and these Bill of Rights. It's all a bunch of perception management and brainwashing, reinforced by laws, a judicial system, and representatives that you get through the other status ritual of voting, and these oath of offices, which are basically lies. You think these people care about the Constitution? There's wearing on a Bible that they'll uphold this Constitution, which is basically a 240-some-year-old piece of parchment that was written by Masonic Freemasons slave owners, okay, about freedom. Got it. I covered the fallacy and the status ritual of a representative governance and someone representing you. I covered how this is all collectivism, and Joe called in and we covered the Prussian education system, how this ties into it. I covered how advertising and marketing of a completely different product for a magazine gave birth to the Pledge of Allegiance. We talked about social conditioning and how all these precepts are social conditioning and basically mind control. We covered on how that's impounded and indoctrinated you into school systems. And we covered the hypocrisy of oaths. I pretty much covered everything I wanted to cover, and I have 20 minutes left. I think I'm going to enjoy the rest of my Saturday. I'm going to shut it down here. I want to thank Joe for calling in, all the listeners. Tune in tomorrow, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. We got another show here on Truth Emerges. Basically have a show every day, 6 p.m., 9 p.m. 6 p.m. on the West Coast, 9 p.m. Eastern. You guys in the middle, fill in the blanks. This has been your host, Anarchy Austin Thomas, here doing statist rituals, covering them. American ones. I mean, we could probably get in further into other countries. A lot of these cross over here on Unraveling the Matrix. Thanks again. I appreciate Joe for calling. I appreciate all the listeners. Till next time, I'm going to close it on down, throw you guys some deuces. Peace out. I'm out of here. Peace out, everybody.